Welcome to another edition of the New Books in Anthropology podcast. We're joined today by Professor Jeffrey Cohen. And Jeff, I'm going to let you introduce yourself because you know your recent dealings a little bit better than I do.
Sure. Thanks, Jared. It's really lovely to be here. My name is Jeffrey Cohen. I'm a professor of anthropology at The Ohio State.
Welcome to another edition of the New Books in Anthropology podcast. We're joined today by Professor Jeffrey Cohen. And Jeff, I'm going to let you introduce yourself because you know your recent dealings a little bit better than I do.
Sure. Thanks, Jared. It's really lovely to be here. My name is Jeffrey Cohen. I'm a professor of anthropology at The Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio. And my research focuses on migration, a little bit on food, and a little bit on development, as well as methodologies.
And of course, since you're on this podcast, we understand you have a new book out.
Right. So I published a couple years ago, I published the book Eating Soup Without a Spoon, Anthropological Theory and Method in the Real World. And in the book, what I do is to really explore how in doing our research, we bring theory to life and how we kind of operationalize some of those theoretical ideas so that we can actually, you know, find them in the field. And I tell the story through really looking at my field work from the early 90s when I spent a year living in a small indigenous community in southern Mexico, a little place called Santa Ana del Valle in Oaxaca. And the title comes from probably one of the most pivotal experiences that my wife Marie and I had while we were doing this research. It was early in our stay, and our patron, this was the person that we lived with, who owned a lot of houses around the community, and we were living in one of them. He came to our house early one morning and basically grabbed us and said, "It's time to go to a wedding." And it was our introduction really to the world of the community and the people who live there. And in the process, the title comes from the experience of being at that wedding and joining in with everybody in breakfast, which was a big bowl of soup that was called a higaditos, and not having a spoon, learning how to eat that with tortillas and interacting with the community around us. And really, it was the, in a sense, a coming out party for us, because from then on, we were always the gringos. We were Mauricio's gringos. He was the guy who, again, our patron. And, you know, it gave us this identity, and it was actually a rather comical moment when we had to, you know, eat these things, not really knowing how to do any of it. So it was quite a little experience.
Well, as anthropologists, we're pretty much required to go on adventure from time to time, right?
Yeah. I guess this was our adventure. It was not one that we had anticipated in any sense. You know, there are so many things that we do to get ready for our research, and it ranges from, you know, learning a language, in this case, learning Spanish and a little bit of Zapotec, to, you know, getting at theoretical ideas and how those were going to be modeled. And for me, that was really a question of how does this community adapt to its growing space in a globalizing economy. And, you know, this was a moment to kind of meet everybody. I think we had been in the village maybe 10 days at this point. So it was still very new to all of us. And it was just, it really helped. I mean, we met a lot of, we met so many people. I found lots of people that then went on to become informants. People knew who we were, which was very nice. It wasn't sort of like we were an unknown sort of quantity or quality. And from then on, we started getting invited to things, going with the families that we were staying with, and it kind of just grew.
Now, this became a field site for you, of course, and you've published on the area and the culture there. What I'm wondering is, why write the book now as a retrospective instead of having written it sooner?
That's a really good question. I actually thought a lot about this book. This book is, in fact, rooted in some writing I did, I think, in the 1990s. And it actually developed out of a class in ethnographic field methods when a student asked me why I didn't like everybody in my field site. And that really grew. I mean, it kind of hit me as that was a very tough question. And I realized that there's very much there's a way of characterizing anthropological research. I think a lot of anthropological research and the time that we spend doing our field work, it tends to get represented on the one hand as almost like I don't want to make this sound worse than it is, but it's almost as if you're kind of like bigger than life. You know, it's not quite being a god in the field, but it's sort of like, you know, I am this ego, and you know, everybody is here to help me, and you become kind of the heroic figure in the story. So that's kind of one side. On the other side, you get stories of anthropologists where everything kind of fails, and at some level it's almost a comical kind of characterization of the experience, and you get this, the quality becomes one of, I can't believe I lived through all of this to tell you something about it. And I really felt like there were that missing in between those two was any account of how we take the ideas that we learn and make them into things we can study. And so what I really wanted to do was tell this story about how this very specific question, how do Santanderos, these are the people that live in the community, how are they kind of adapting to this place in a globalizing economic system? And so that's what, you know, the book documents were those experiences. And I think at some level, for me, I'm not sure I could have written it before. I think I had to be in a place where I was ready and I was kind of comfortable with myself, and I wasn't too afraid to kind of show how difficult the experience was and really walk away from any of those caricatures of the anthropologists in the field.
Speaking of caricatures, during a good portion of the book, especially the intro, I was having just brief glimpses of Malinowski.
Yes.
Was that intentional? And also, how did you reflect on Malinowski's writing and sort of work around some of the negatives with which he tends to be associated?
Right. Well, this was really important, I think, was that I refer to them as ghosts, like ghosts of the field. And Malinowski wasn't the only one. He was there. Margaret Mead was there. Franz Boas was there. Elsie Clues Parsons, who's a person who did her research in the region, she's there. And these are people who, in a sense, you know, they're not real. These were the people who were the ghosts in my head, the people that I was always worried how would they react to what I was doing. And I found myself on many occasions actually writing to them. I would write very specific letters to people like Malinowski and Margaret Mead and Elsie Clues Parsons and Franz Boas, and I would tell them what I was doing in a way that I thought maybe they would understand how anthropology was changing as we were coming into the 1990s from their work in the early parts of the 20th century. That was really useful. It's actually become part of the way I teach at this point is to use those letters. I ask my students to actually write to anthropologists or other scientists that they want to tell about their work. It's a way, I think, to kind of confront our demons. It's also a way to think about our own voices and how we're representing what we do.
On that note, in looking into this in terms of what audience you had in mind, I get the impression you were writing this for undergraduates.
Yeah, I think it's mostly a book for undergraduates who are learning ethnographic field methods. For graduate students, I would hope they would pick it up and just be, in a sense, reassured that it's okay. They can make mistakes, that it's not all going to go perfectly, that there are going to be days when they just don't want to get out of bed. There are going to be days when they just, their informants are driving them crazy. And the theories that they're in their heads are, I'm never going to answer these questions. So I think it's for, you know, a big audience. I'd like to think that anybody could pick it up and have a an interesting experience learning about how to do research. But it really does come out of that kind of moment in time where undergraduates are beginning to learn how to do their research. Part of what I try to do is to share with them how to create kind of a calendar and how, you know, your work develops through your stay and so on. But also, I can remember just being so nervous that I wasn't getting what I needed or that I was going to miss something. And so for the student who's working on his or her dissertation research, I just want them to remember that it's okay. You're not going to get everything, that there are going to be moments when it's going to feel very weird.
And weirdness is sort of our stock in trade, isn't it?
Yeah, sometimes I think, yeah. It's certainly when people look at us, I can remember people in my field saying like, what are you still doing here? You know, you've been here for 2 weeks. So, yeah.
Now, as a bit of a teaser, portions of the book are very clearly giving advice to novice field researchers. What are a couple of main points that you would tell someone specifically going into the field for the first time?
Well, I think the most important thing is not to take yourself too seriously, because you're asking people to open up their lives and share a lot of information with you. And, you know, there's an exchange going on, and you have to be ready to kind of hold your part of the bargain up. And part of that exchange is you're going to make it interesting. And I think if you take yourself too seriously, you can put yourself into a position that people are going to have a hard time talking. Certainly, one of the most important things to know is never to tell somebody that they're wrong, because nobody's wrong. I kind of start by talking about rapport and how people can kind of fool around with the truth. Some people would say, you know, talking about lying. And I don't think people generally lie. I think they're playing around with words and they're playing around with stories. And really, if we walk in overly serious about the work that we're going to do, there's usually somebody in that community who's going to start kind of feeding us lines that are going to sound really incredible, but it's going to be a story, not so much the reality.
But one of the more incredible things about your story involves grasshoppers, and the concept of entomophagy. Would you mind speaking to that a little bit?
Sure. So one of the foods that's consumed in the rural villages in Oaxaca Central Valleys are grasshoppers. They're called chapulín. So they are grasshoppers that are toasted served cooked. There's a couple of different kinds. They're little, the nymphs that they very often refer to as babies, and then the adults. Sometimes they'll have a little bit of flavor, but generally they're just toasted with a little bit of lemon and maybe a little bit of garlic, and served up rolled into tortillas, or served as a kind of garnish on some salsas or something, like a salsa on other sorts of foods. And they tend to be very high in protein, very pretty healthy. We ran some tests just to look at contamination that might be present, and nothing really showed up. So they seem pretty safe. They can be contaminated by the pots that they're prepared in, so they can pick up contamination from, like lead contamination from pots that have a lot of lead in them. But on their own, they can be you know, pretty tasty. He learned to love them. I can remember being up in the mountains one morning, working with Mauricio, and he pulled out a bag and he's like, "Hey, gringo, look what I got for you." That was one of those moments when it was like, all right, I'm an anthropologist. I'm just going to eat this, and I'm not going to give him the pleasure of watching me get disgusted. But I discovered that they were pretty tasty, and I'm happy to eat them now. And that's worth it, that I actually continue to do, is looking at the role that the grasshoppers play in the changing diet in the Central Valleys.
How common is it as a part of the typical diet of a Oaxacan versus when I lived in China, insect cuisine is somewhat common, but it's usually seen as more touristy these days. It hasn't been a staple for a long time.
Right. I think it's very similar in Mesoamerica and Mexico. So they were available everywhere. They're on menus at lots of touristy restaurants. You don't see very many people eating them anymore. What you see are tourists eating them. I think there's a lot of things going on in terms of how the diet is changing. It's certainly been transformed in the last 20 years to a diet that's built much more around store-bought foods and pre-prepared foods. And so there is a real decline in the consumption of grasshoppers. The history of their consumption is also really something that needs to be understood better. It's work that I kind of chip away at, but it's very hard to follow. There's not very much. There's not a lot of detail in terms of the consumption of chapulín. What you actually see a lot of are stories about Mesoamericans eating water insects and the eggs of water insects. And there's some research that some archaeologists have done that show in central Mexico pulling literally tons of insect eggs out of the shallow lakes that made up the Valley of Mexico. And that was probably one of the most important protein sources for the region.
You know, entomophagy is often written off as something kitschy or touristy, as you said, but it's important to note that as an agricultural industry, it's extremely productive and reproducible. It doesn't have the same ecological impact as animals.
Right, right. No, absolutely, absolutely. It can be very sustainable, and it certainly doesn't create the kinds of challenges that large mammals create, you know.
And I certainly saw a lot of large mammals when I was living in both the Midwest and Texas. And I have to bring up that we're both Hoosiers.
We are both Hoosiers. And so, yes, we live in a world defined by, I guess, corn, soybean, and cows. I don't know.
So was it a market? A drastic change when you went on your initial field work?
Yes. So My wife Marie and I, we drove from Bloomington, Indiana to Mexico in a Honda Civic. And it was pretty incredible, the changes that we went through. The most incredible thing I remember actually is coming home. And we get back to Indiana. We'd spent over a year in Mexico. And we get back to Indiana. And we went to where my parents were living at the time. And they said, "Well, why didn't you call us and tell us that you were?" And I had become so comfortable living without a phone, and this was before cell phones and everything else. But we were living in a community of about 2,000 people with one telephone for everyone, that we just had not even remembered that it was something to use. And so that really kind of threw us a little bit. So
I've certainly gone through the same thing with air conditioning.
I just can't. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know that I'll ever be used to that again.
Yeah.
I also like to joke that as you drive southwest across the United States, the flags become bigger.
They probably do. Yeah. Yeah. I can remember also stopping on the way down on the highway when we got to the tropics, when we crossed the line into the tropics. So we got out of the car and we took pictures. So that we had, you know, 1 foot in the tropics and 1 foot in the northern hemisphere. It's very, you know, cheesy but fun.
It's important to be taken out of your physical environs as well as cultural,
right,
for this sort of activity. Excellent. So as far as what you're working on now and in the future, what can we expect to see from you?
So I continue to work on the migration, questions of migration, with a colleague of mine, a geographer who's named Ibrahim Sirkeci. He and I, we've developed a model of insecurity and migration, and we talk about that in our book, The Cultures of Migration. And so that's something we continue to work on. We're bringing in comparative material. So he does work mostly on Turkish migration. So we compare Turkish and Mexican outcomes. There are a lot of interesting parallels between Kurdish minority migrants moving into Europe and Oaxacan migrants moving to the United States. So we do comparative work. There's some work that I've been doing with some colleagues in China that's been really fun. And then there is this work on methodology, on entomophagy. And, you know, I feel in my career that I'm in a place where I can do those things now, can kind of enjoy looking at things that were always interesting to me, but I just didn't have time to look at in the past.
That sounds like very exciting stuff. Are you going to be at AAA this year?
I will be at AAA and presenting, I think I'm a discussant on a panel. It's archaeologists talking about abandonment, and they asked me to comment on what abandonment means for migration research. And it's a very interesting question, so I'll be working on that.
I'm very much looking forward to it. And as a final note, can you give us some more details about the book? Where to buy? Who's the publisher?
Sure. So you can find this book at my at its home at the University of Texas Press. It's also available on Amazon. If you have a hard time finding it, you can always email me. I'm easily accessible through the OSU, the Ohio State University website. I'm happy to talk to anybody that picks up the book, has questions, wants to know something else. Just drop me a message and I'll be more than happy to talk your ear off.
Excellent. And how can listeners contact you?
So the best way to contact me is through my email, and that's my last name, Cohen, C-O-H-E-N, and it's cohen.319@osu.edu, and that's at the OSU, that's the OSU site. And you can also always find me through the anthropology department at Ohio State.
Excellent. Where, as I understand it, you teach a very popular class known as the zombie class.
Yes, I do teach the zombie class. Yeah. So that class is completely different than anything else I've ever done. I thought, how do we make introductory anthropology something really, really different? And so I use zombies and other monsters as a way to introduce anthropology and bring it to life, or maybe afterlife, I suppose, for the students who are involved. And we end up looking at a lot of the ways in which anthropologists study things like death and the afterlife and other kinds of things that are associated with zombies, like cannibalism and, I mean, all kinds of fun stuff. And the part my students, I think, love the most is that we run up a contest, and it's called America's Got Zombies. And it's sort of a take on America's Got Talent. And so I have a series of goals that need to be met that are associated with different kinds of zombies. And then the students create a version of that for themselves. They become a zombie and tell us how what they do, why they're the way they are, you know, things like why don't they run? Why do they run? What do they eat? What don't they eat? Do they think? Do they not? You know, all kinds of fun things that really bring it right into anthropology. But it's fun. It's like Halloween on Fridays in my class. So I enjoy it a lot.
That's a fantastic way to introduce ethnography and that mode of thought to newer students. Outstanding.
Yeah, I find it very satisfying when students tell me, oh, you don't have to do anything but get dressed up. And I feel, okay, that's one down. I've got you. So.
Excellent. Well, Jeffrey, it's been great. Is there anything else that you'd like to ask or let the viewers know? Our listeners, I should say.
I don't think so. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about the book and my work. And again, if anyone's listening, has questions, please just let me know. I'm happy to talk.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you, Jared. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
Okay. That was Professor Jeffrey Cohen with his new book, Eating Soup Without a Spoon. You can pick that up online from the University of Texas Press, and he will be at AAA this year, so be sure to stop in and check him out. And this has been another episode of New Books in Anthropology. If you'd like to listen to more of our material, just return to any podcast outlet that you have found this on, and the rest of our episodes will be available.